How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How you doing?
I'm dandy. Just dandy.
Well,
just
good.
Dandyful. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Dandyful. That's a nice word.
Thank you. I just made it up.
Nice.
I'm full of dandy.
You are. Mm-hmm.
How are you? What's going on?
I'm doing well. I just finished writing this episode. It is so convoluted, and there are so many rabbit holes that if I didn't stop writing, it would have taken me 3 more months. And yeah. It would have been an entire podcast within itself.
It actually probably could be, now that you say that. And well, I don't even really know what it's about.
I believe there is a podcast on this and all the different links and everything like that. I should have, but I don't know if it's actual facts or if it's just...
You put it in the show notes, Jen.
I'll put it in the show notes. I'm not sure what it is. I haven't listened to it because I really try to steer clear of any podcasts that have done this because for fear of, you know, plagiarizing and all that other stuff. I don't want to be accused of that. But I will tell you, now that we're saying the plagiarizing, I did get most the info from a book, although there is tons and tons and tons and tons of news articles about it. The book on this case was the most concise and to the point. The book is written by the detective that actually helped solve this case, and it's called Young Blood by Bob O'Brien.
Oh, Bobby O'Brien. Boy, does that not sound like a police officer's name or what?
Bob O'Brien, yes. Now, this case is very popular in Australia from where it takes place. It was huge media scandal. I believe it's still brought up today, but I don't think it's very well known here in the States or other parts of the world because it happened in the 70s and 80s before the internet and all that sort of stuff. So shall we start?
Let's do it. I'm excited.
This all happened in Adelaide in Australia.
Let's
all right.
Go. Let's go.
One thing about this case, it's extremely graphic. One good thing about getting this from the police officer is I was able to find more details. And of course, I'm a sucker for details. I am kind of a sucker for gore, so I'm sorry if I offend anybody, but just know that this is very explicit and I will be getting into detail. 16-year-old Alan Barnes from Salisbury, Australia, which is just about 12 miles from Adelaide, went missing on Sunday, June 17th, 1979. He was very fit, good-looking, blonde teenager. Everybody loved him. The day before, Alan had stayed the night with a friend. They had woke up late, ate breakfast, and then the two set off to hitchhike back to Alan's house. You know, it was 70s, late 70s, early 80s. Everybody was hitchhiking everywhere.
Yeah, and I think in the United States, it has such a bad rap that people don't really do it. But I
Well, not believe... anymore. They did.
No, but I mean, I think over there, a lot of times, like the kids and stuff, the younger people that are traveling in Europe and things still hitchhike occasionally.
Possibly. But like I said, this was back in 1979. So they set off to hitchhike back to Alan's house. Well, they didn't have any luck with getting a ride. And even though they were on a very, very busy main road, well, Alan's friend just kind of gave up and left Alan to hitch a ride by himself. He pretty much claimed that Alan would have an easier time getting a ride by himself. Easier to pick up one hitchhiker, especially male, and not two, right?
Where'd he go?
He just went back home.
Oh, okay. Because
he was staying at the friend's, right? On Monday morning, after not seeing or hearing from Alan for a while, which was very not like him, his mother called the police. The police went and asked the general public if anybody had seen Alan or if they had heard anything from him. And unfortunately, they didn't get much of a response back. But someone, one person, did say that they saw someone matching Alan's description getting into a white Holden sedan with three or four people on Grand Junction Road. Now, that was the road that Alan's friend had left him on. Unfortunately, 1 week later, Alan's broken body was found lying in the mud under a reservoir bridge. Oh. Someone had thrown his body off the bridge, hoping that the water would wash it away and never to be seen again. But unfortunately, due to the lack of rain, the water level was low. So he basically landed in the mud. Oh. The fall had left Alan with a broken body, but police think he was already dead by the time he was discarded like trash. A post-mortem revealed that Alan had had a drug called Noctec, which is basically a chloral hydrate in his system. We talked about this drug before. It's a knockout drop, right? It's like a Mickey Finn, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He had that in his system, and he also had high levels of alcohol. Now, police didn't think much. He was a teenager. He kind of experimented with drugs. He drank a little bit, but he had really high levels of alcohol in his system, more than normal. Alan had also been beaten, tortured, and sexually assaulted. Now, in fact, they believe he had died from blood loss from the wounds of his rape.
The
pathologist suggested that something like a bottle or some other kind of hard object with a tapered neck had been inserted so far into Alan's anus that it had split open and caused his massive blood loss.
That's terrible.
Isn't it awful? But the weird thing, the clothes that Alan was found in, there wasn't a drop of blood on him.
I was just going to say totally clean.
Totally clean. Police think that he was held for at least a week somewhere while his captors abused him. They kept him drugged and possibly naked so he couldn't fight back or try to get away.
That just gives me the heebie-jeebies. Mm-hmm. Like that would be one of my worst nightmares ever.
Me too. They believed Alan died on that Friday before he was found and that his captors had washed his body, redressed him, and then on Saturday night, they threw him off the bridge into what they thought was the water below. No clues. There wasn't a lot of evidence to be found at the site where Alan was found. There wasn't anything. All that the police know is it was very unusual, and they thought maybe just he got into a fight somewhere or a sexual sadist. They didn't have anything to go on. They even offered a reward to find any information, but nothing ever came about. Then a few months later, on Tuesday, August 28th, 1979, a fisherman comes across two trash bags that had been caught on the rocks near a wharf that had no longer been used. It wasn't any longer in service. The water had been low, I guess, and the bags snagged on some rocks, instead of going out to sea, they were caught. The fisherman, of course, looked inside the bags. I don't know why he would look inside.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Would you? No. I would not.
When he did look inside the bags, he found human body parts.
See?
Now, the torso had all of its internal organs removed and legs shoved inside the torso. You know, like a kind of like when you cut up a chicken or a turkey and you take out all the internal organs and you just have a cavity. It was just a torso with legs shoved inside the body cavity.
What is the point of that?
Well, the head was tied with a yellow plastic cord. The cord was brought up through the neck, out the mouth, and then tied to one of the top ribs of his body.
Like a purse? Like a carry-all?
Like to make sure.
Made a circle?
The head wasn't touched at all, except, yeah, like it was, yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah, it was attached, right? Horrible. He was decapitated. Police thought the reason why this was done basically was to make it easier to get rid of the body, like to care if they were going to carry a body out, it was easier to cut it up and put it in bags. Police had identified the body as 25-year-old Neil Muir. Now, Neil was known to the police. He was a heavy heroin user, did all sorts of drugs. He just was known to the police. Let's just put it that way. The pathologist found that Neil had suffered a horrible blow to the back of his head, but that's not what killed him. He found that Neil had died most likely from blood loss from a massive rip in his anus, just like Alan Barnes. But, you know, that's where the similarities end. I'll just say that some things that I've read said that there were drugs found in his system, like methadone, because he was also addicted to methadone, and they found other narcotics in his system. But there were no internal organs found with his body.
They took those out of him, too?
No, to Neil. There was no internal organs found on Neil, because they had taken them all out to put his legs in.
Are they selling them?
Well, this is where it really gets gross. So let me describe the whole thing of Neil. After Neil was killed, someone used a saw where they think it might have been a surgical saw, and they cut his spine in two places. Not only did they decapitate him, they cut his arms and legs off, but also they cut off all his fingers and thumbs. His pelvis had been separated from his torso and spine, and the flesh and muscle tissue had been removed from his arms and legs, just leaving the bones. Now, like I said, all of his internal organs were removed. There weren't any to be found in the bags. His scrotum had been cut open and one of his testicles removed, but they never found that other testicle.
I guess if they're harvesting them, you wouldn't find it.
Well,
how could you? You can't harvest that. That's like oh my God.
No. Well, I'll let you know. Harvesting's never once was mentioned, but that's a good point. The head of his penis had been cut off. And the penis shaft had been cut down the middle. All of the tattoos that Neil had were cut from his arms and legs. Now, you would think that, you know, they cut off his fingers, they cut off his tattoos, that they were going to try to conceal his identity.
Mm-hmm.
But the tattoos and everything were placed inside a bag that was placed in a torso along with his legs.
Like they do with turkey at Thanksgiving.
Kind of.
That is terrible. Is that what they were doing?
I don't know.
Sick.
The police only suspect that he was mutilated. His body was mutilated and like that just to make for easy disposal.
Yeah, but some of that seems a little overdone.
You'd think. And also in one of the bags was a Band-Aid and there was fiber stuck to like the gluey part of the Band-Aid. You know how Band-Aids or plasters stick to you with the gluey part? Mm-hmm. So there were some fibers there. Police immediately don't suspect that Neil and Alan Barnes are related. Not that they're related, you know, mom and dad, but they don't think the murders are connected because Neil Muir led the lifestyle that he led with the drugs. Police pretty much thought this was all drug related. You know, maybe Neil owed somebody money and it was a huge hit, you know.
Yeah. I mean, just because they're both so brutal and with the anus injury.
Yeah, that's not something common that happens.
You see that all the time.
You would see that more likely in female bodies, but not really in men, male.
But men. I get that they led very different lifestyles. So
right.
Probably. Yeah.
I mean, Alan was a teenager of 16. He was a party boy that was just like starting to experiment with drugs and alcohol, but he wasn't a hard hitting heroin abuser like Neil was. I mean, Neil went from heroin, then he got addicted to methadone, then he got addicted to, you know, he was just an addict. So, you know, police are thinking that this is all he owed a drug runner money, something, you know, something to deal with drugs. And then they receive two phone calls from two separate people. And these people stated that they knew that Neil had this relationship with a doctor, had some sort of relationship, right? Now,
a male doctor.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, being maybe a medical saw was used, they start looking into this case, right? Now, it's got to be later in the fall, 1979, and police thought they knew for sure who Neil Muir's killer was. In fact, they named him as Dr. Peter Leslie Milhouse, and he was a general practitioner. He was also known as an alcoholic, and he was gay. And just to let it know that homosexuality was decriminalized in Australia in 1975. Much more progressive than the USA, right? And plus, Dr. Milhouse was also known to hang out in the seedy hotels looking for love. He was quite the lonely man. Now, Dr. Milhouse and Neil Muir had known each other for about 4 years But it's uncertain. There's no proof that they were ever physically, if they were lovers or if they were romantically involved. Although rumor had it that they had been lovers, like Neil may have done favors for drugs for the doctor. Mm-hmm. And although it was never proved that Dr. Milhouse gave Neil drugs, the doctor did express to somebody that he was worried that he might get in trouble for supplying subscriptions to other drug addicts in the area. Mm-hmm. Dr. Milhouse was seen drinking with Neil the Sunday it was thought Neil had disappeared. But later a bouncer had come forward and said he had thrown Neil out of a bar that Monday afternoon at 1:30, which was about 24 hours before his remains were found in garbage bags. Funny enough, after his body was murdered, the doctor went on this huge drunk weekend, like this whole a bender, if you will, right? And while he was coming off of said bender, he contacted a very well-known criminal lawyer, and then he admitted himself into a rehab center.
Well, that's not looking good for him.
Mm-hmm, not at all. And then later, when the police tried to contact Dr. Milhouse to ask him questions, the doctor handed him a letter from the lawyer, which stated he didn't want to answer any of those questions. Suspicious much, you think? Crime scene police searched the doctor's home, and because witness said that, you know, Dr. Milhouse had those types of garbage bags that Neil was found in, and other had seen a yellow cord that Neil's was attached Neil's head to his body, same type they said the doctor used on his clothesline. But when his house was actually searched, there's a different type of string on the clothesline. So they don't know if maybe it had been changed, if they had to change because there was, he had used the clothesline. Nothing really could be found. And plus, all these items were common. Like almost every household in Australia at the time had these items. They tested the bathroom and it did show that there had been blood on the floor, but there was not enough to identify it as Neil's. And the house cleaner that Dr. Milhouse employed was spoken to, and she verified that she had cleaned the bathroom, and she had cleaned up what looked like blood streaks around the bathroom wall, and that was, she thinks, around the same time as Neil's death. And as for the fibers on the Band-Aid, they were similar to what was on the rug at the doctor's house, but they could not say for sure that that's where it came from.
There would have to be so much blood. I mean, essentially, that poor guy was like bloodlet. Like there was, you know, like there had to be. Where would you even commit that?
Right.
There would have to be evidence left behind.
Even though there wasn't a lot of evidence or anything to go on, police knew that Dr. Milhouse was the murderer. So they arrested him and charged him for the murder of Neil Muir. When they went to trial, you know, they didn't really have much. The evidence was mostly circumstantial. I mean, they did have upwards of 60 witnesses ready to go. But what the prosecution didn't have was hard evidence, nor did they have a motive. Why would Dr. Milhouse kill Neil, right? There's no
reason. Why would anybody kill anybody, though?
But they couldn't even come up with a lame excuse, you know? Like, they couldn't even say, well, Neil was going to go to the cops because I was giving him prescriptions. They didn't even have that, really. So it's not surprising that Dr. Milhouse was found not guilty in a court of law. Although Detective Lee, his name is Lee Haddon, he believed without a doubt that the doctor was guilty. Like, he swore the doctor was guilty. Dr. Peter Milhouse died in 2015 at the age of 80 years old. Now, I was reading later, and they thought maybe the blood, since it was just streaks of blood on the bathroom walls, that maybe somebody was using heroin, and the blood splashed up against the wall, that could have been. Which could be that Neil was in the doctor's house and overdosed.
Well, they were friends, or whatever. Friends. Friends are friends, right?
They knew each other is all we can say. Right.
Yeah.
They knew each other. They were seen drinking together. They were acquaintances, as far as anybody knew. So maybe that happened. Maybe Dr. Milhouse. Who knows? We can only speculate, correct?
Correct.
Especially now that Dr. Milhouse is dead. Everything goes quiet. 2 years pass. And in late February of 1982, 18-year-old Mark Langley is reported missing by his parents. Now, Mark had been out with his parents to a party the night before, But he had, his parents had gone home and went to bed or did whatever they did. And Mark stayed out later with two friends. And the two friends, Ian and Pam, were boyfriend and girlfriend. And they were all driving along at the car. And about 1:30, they decide to pull over and start talking. And Ian and Mark get in some kind of stupid argument. Supposedly it's about cigarettes. I don't know.
They're always dumb. Yeah. It happened.
They're dumb. Now, they had parked the car by the Torrens River, and that runs right through the center of Adelaide. Mark got mad at Ian and got out of the car like big macho guys do in a huff, and he walked off. Ian and Pam, not thinking anything of it, drove off, but circled around. They came back at about 4 minutes later. They're not going to really leave him there. Mark was gone. They couldn't find him. He'd disappeared. They checked around the areas, couldn't find him. So they just thought, you know what? He probably went to hitch a ride and we'll see him tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But nope, he was never to be seen again. Except on March 8th, Mark's body was found just off a road, partially hidden under a brush. Now, he was in the clothes that he was wearing when he disappeared. And this is so early 80s. When he disappeared, he was in blue jeans, a blue satin shirt, like a cardigan, and he had a necklace with the zodiac symbol for Cancer.
Was that area known to be frequented by, like, I don't know, tourist or a hotspot for gay men pickup? Or...
Matter of fact, the River Torrens was the number one pickup place for, and I'll kind of describe that later. There was rumors that Neil was, but Neil was possibly gay for pay.
Gay for drugs, yeah.
Right. And that's all we can say about anything. But what was interesting, Mark was wearing the clothes he was missing even the necklace, but whoever redressed him didn't put his shirt on, just put the cardigan on, not the shirt.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And were the clothes clean again, like the other guys?
The clothes were fine, but we'll get back. So Mark's body, mostly, though his head and neck, had been exposed to the elements, so they had started to decompose a bit. So the police believe his body had been there for about a week before he was discovered. Pathologists, once again, discovered a high amount of alcohol and the drug Noctec. And
same drug.
Same drug, but this time they also found Mandrax, which is a quaalude, in his bloodstream. Pathologists also found that Mark had the same gash on his anus. And he died of blood loss, but also knew he had a wound on his abdomen that had been stitched up. Now, someone had cut him in the abdomen, which started about 2 inches right above his penis and went for about 6.5 inches just right of the middle of his abdomen. He had been stitched back together.
The stitches clean, like mm-hmm. a doctor?
Yes, he had been stitched up together. And then covered with surgical tape. Now, when they said surgical tape, it was more like that Johnson & Johnson white tape that you get. Yep. That's what I believe. They kept saying Johnson & Johnson surgical tape. So what I'm thinking is just the tape that we use to cover big wounds with like the mesh.
Gauze.
Yeah. With gauze mesh. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking it is. But what's weird is around the wound, it looked like the hair had been shaved before the cut was made. And then when they opened the wound, they found that a bit of his small intestines, a bit of Mark's small intestines was missing.
What is with this? What is that?
Well, the police believe that Mark was cut open or operated on or whatever you want to call it to get something that was in his bowels. Like possibly they put something in his rectum and it got stuck. And they thought maybe it had fingerprints on it, something. So they cut out that part to get the item that was in.
That's not what I thought you were going to say. Like he swallowed drugs, like Mm-mm. a mule runner, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-mm. But once again, there's not a lot of evidence to go on, and the investigation stalls. So on June 23rd, 1982, pretty much right after Mark had been found, a farmer had called police to notify them that he had been out burning the fields, his fields, to clear the land, and he had stumbled upon skeletal remains. Now, unfortunately, the body had been burned in the fire. So the police brought in the skeletal remains, but with, you know, the help of teeth, they were able to identify it, the body or skeleton, as belonging to 14-year-old Peter Stogniff. Peter was last seen after he skipped school to go to the mall on Thursday, the 27th, August 1981, which was about 6 months before Mark Langley disappeared. Now, police had known about Peter's disappearance when he first went missing, and they investigated, they launched an investigation, but the only lead they had was one witness claimed they had seen a boy that matched Peter's description, and he had been with a man at the Tea Tree Plaza, which I believe was the mall. Peter, his skeleton had been cut into three pieces. His back had been cut through, his legs had been cut up above the knees, and his lower legs were missing. And police believe that the same saw that was used to cut Neil was also used on Peter.
Okay, here's my other question. Did all of these boys look similar? Did they have similar looks?
They were all young and they were all good looking. Alan was blonde. Neil was a brunette. Mark had dark hair, handsome. Peter also had dark hair, but they were all young and they were all cute. Now they had four bodies of men between the ages of 14 to 25 years old, and they've all been found in the course of 2 years. Now, police were at a loss. You know, they didn't know these were all similar, you know. Peter obviously was cut up like Neil, but since there wasn't any body tissue, it was just a skeleton, they couldn't tell how Peter had died. You know, there was all some kind of similarities, but were they all committed by the same people or person? Was there a copycat out there? It was hard to tell because they were just had so little evidence. But the only thing the police were sure at this point is that the young men in Adelaide were being abducted and brutally murdered. And
viciously.
They were
butchered. They're being butchered.
They were being butchered. And they were at a loss on who was doing it. Once again, silence. Nothing happens for about a year. Then 15-year-old Richard Kelvin goes missing. On Sunday, June 5th, 1983, Richard and his friend Boris were at a park playing football. Now, Richard's dad was with them earlier, but he had gone home and Richard stayed with his friends to play on. Now, Richard had on jeans, a Channel 9 shirt, because his father was the host of a news program at Channel 9. So he was famous. And also, as a joke, he was wearing a dog's collar that was studded. Like a studded dog yeah. collar. Now, I immediately think punk, like a punk 80s, rock, right?
I think 80s, yeah.
Right. Now, the police are thinking gay, right? So I'll just put that there. I'll just add that now because I never really knew where to put it. But he was wearing this dog collar around his neck. And he's not gay, by the way. He has a girlfriend that he loves, and he was actually talking about marrying her. Even though he was 15, they were going to get married in 4 years when they were 19. I mean, he was smitten with this girl. All right. But anyway, as it starts to get dark, the boys go home and it's about 6 o'clock or so. As they're walking home, they run into a mutual friend and stop to talk. And at this time, a bus drives by and stops and Boris jumps on the bus to go home. And Richard leaves his friend and just starts walking home. Now, he only has about a quarter of a mile left to go, right? Then he comes home, but he never makes it home. He completely vanishes. Nothing. After Boris sees him and waves, that's it. He's gone. Now, at first, the police think, you know, he might have run off with his girlfriend, you know how, or ran away. You know how police,
every teenager
runs in the time, away. Right? Yeah, yeah. They don't take anything seriously. But since this was going to be high profile, you know, his dad is a news anchor, they start knocking on doors. I mean, they would have done this anyway, but it probably helped them knock on doors quicker knowing that the dad was on the news.
Stressed them out a little bit knowing that they're going to have to answer to this
publicly
and quickly and probably, yeah.
Right. Now, so they just don't, they knock on doors everywhere, not just the route that they think, you know, Richard was going to take home. They go everywhere. And lo and behold, one officer interviews a man who was a security guard. And he had lived just around the corner from the Kelvin home. And when I say just around the corner, about 50 yards from the Kelvin home. And this man said that he was asleep because he had the flu. And he went to bed, you know, he had gone to bed because he was tired. But about 6 o'clock, something woke him up. He said about 6:15. He said he heard some cries for help and some car doors banging. He said there was a loud exhaust noise, you know, and the car sped away. And he didn't think much of it at the time because he was sick and he just went back to sleep. Also, and this kind of made me laugh, and I'm sure this is true, but I don't know. I asked my husband about it, and he said he guesses it could be true, too, because I know nothing about cars. The security officer was a car enthusiast. He loved cars. And he said that he could tell the sound the muffler made by what kind of car it was. So his guess was the car was either a Holden or a Ford Falcon. So grain of salt there. I just thought it was kind of funny. I mean, I wouldn't know. I couldn't tell you, you know. But I guess if you're really into cars, you might be able to know this. So anyway, this was all, once again, taken from The Young Blood by Bob O'Neill, his book. Police once again asked the public for help, and they get an anonymous phone call stating that Richard was being kept in a trailer, or as they call it in Australia, a caravan, in Adelaide Hills, which is just east of Adelaide proper. Or the hills is this large wooded area that runs north and south of Adelaide. It's about 40 miles, right? They jump in emergency helicopters and they're sent to search. And there was some trailers. Nothing was found. 7 weeks after Richard was reporting missing, on July 24th, 1983, a man out collecting moss rocks. I don't know why someone would collect moss rocks, maybe for a terrarium. But he was out there and they found Richard's body. Richard was lying in the fetal position on his left-hand side, facing a bush right next to a dirt airstrip. Police searched the area. Now, what's funny, in the book, they call it an emu parade, which I'd never heard of before, so I had to look it up. And basically, it's when they walk side by side to gather evidence, right? You've seen that before.
Yeah,
right?
We call it like a grid search.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Right. They called it an emu parade. And the reason why they called it emu is because every so often someone would duck down, like emus duck down for food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought that was kind of charming, actually.
Never heard of it.
So anyway, they search the area and they collect bottles and debris, but nothing that held evidence of Richard's killer. But they do come across, and this is gross, they do come across a carcass of a dead dog, and it's completely covered in maggots. Now, Richard's body did have some fly larvae on it. They're thinking if they can find out when the dog was dumped, they can put a time frame on when Richard's body was left at the scene. They went searching the area, and they found that a dog had passed like 3 weeks prior and was dumped out and around where Richard was found, right? So that was the dog. So between the decomposition of Richard's body and the work of Beryl Morris, whom the police called the Maggot Lady, how'd you like that moniker? It seemed that Richard was dumped about 2 weeks before anybody found his body. That means somebody had kept Richard alive for 5 weeks.
5 weeks.
Somewhere. Horrible. I mean, this is just a 15-year-old boy. Awful. So upon examining the body, the pathologist said that Richard, of course, had been kept alive the entire time he was missing, and he had suffered like the others. He had marks and bruises from being hit on the head, on his back, and on his right buttock. But all of these injuries seemed to have occurred early in his capture because they were all in the process of healing, right? You know, you get a bruise, and then it turns purple, and then it goes...
So all those injuries were, none of them were fresh?
None of them were fresh.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They also noticed that he had broken his front tooth.
Well, it makes sense if they kept him drugged because he's not going to fight back. So those injuries would be the initial injuries probably right when he was taken or right after, right? So if you're drugged up, you're not going to fight back or tied up. So you wouldn't have any fresh injuries.
Right. They also found that somehow one of Richard's front teeth had been broken, and it must have happened sometime either right before he died or right after he died. They weren't sure. And of course, just like the others, he had the same anal injuries and had died of blood loss, and then washed and redressed after his death. Now, he was found in the exact same clothes he left. The shirt, the dog collar, the tennis shoes, everything was the same.
That's so bizarre. I guess they stripped it off of him.
Mm-hmm.
Right when
and
they
he
got
was
him.
Kept naked, probably.
Kept naked, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Could they tell if they were sexually assaulted, too? Meaning, like, were they penetrated?
There was no... They did not find any semen or any DNA in the areas at all. Nothing.
Oh, God, that's terrible. Okay.
They'd all been washed off. If there was, it had been washed off. Because the bodies were washed. Now, blood toxicology. And when I say blood toxicology, I mean, they lost an extreme amount of blood, but... They get it from, like, the organs, right?
Mm-hmm.
From the bodies.
Well, except for the one that didn't have any organs, but yeah.
And that's why there wasn't any blood, or that's why they couldn't tell if there was any drugs in his system. The toxicology revealed that alcohol was in his system, along with 5 hypnotic drugs. He had the Mandrax, he had the Notec, he had Amitol and Valium. Those were all in his... Amitol, I believe, is like another...
Is that like the Valium, too?
I believe it's a Valium. Now, all those drugs were in his system or in his bloodstream, and they were definite. And then they also found very, very small, minute traces of Rohfenol. But there wasn't enough to be 100% certain. In fact, the pathologist thought they might have found like a injection wound on his arm, but wasn't exactly sure. That was just like a side blip. That it was never, like, for certain. Police go over Richard's clothes. They start taking tape and pressing it onto the fabric to get fiber samples, right? Like you do with everything. Well, this time they got lucky. They pulled up fibers. Some that they could match with Richard's clothes. Others they couldn't. Some sites said they found 925 fibers. Others said only 525 fibers. Anyway, there is a lot of fibers. So they took these fibers and they separated them into different colors, turquoise, purple, orange, yellow, black, brown, red, and green. Hmm. And they sent them off to be tested. Also, foreign hairs were found inside of Richard's jeans. Inside of Richard's jeans, not on the outside. So as the case drags on, more people started coming forward saying that they had heard Richard being abducted. One said that they heard distinct, different voices, like very different voices, one being higher than the other.
Female.
Like a female. Mm-hmm. The other, a car door slamming and a car speeding off. Another, a woman heard someone yell and possibly 3 to 4 different voices, possibly a female. And then the sound of screeching tires. And then another couple came forward saying they heard 2 males talking and they also heard a very loud sounding car. So now police are starting to think that more than one person is involved because they have witnesses to corroborate it.
Then let me just say here, one person doing this is beyond sick and disgusting. I cannot imagine that there would be multiple people that would do this together.
How do you keep that a secret?
Well, plus
somebody's going to talk.
Doesn't one of them have any sense? I mean, I'm not going to say my standard line here. I'm going to refrain, but you know what I'm saying.
I know.
Out of all of them, somebody's not like, hey, this is a bad idea.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't do this. Yeah.
And the fact that the torture took weeks, it's not like it's like a 30-minute, you know, bad decision, right? Mm-hmm. This is multiple days of, oh my, this is horrible. I can't believe I've never heard this case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I know. I was shocked when I first saw it. Okay, so at this point, as you know, the media is going nuts. High-profile case. The dad's on the news. It's a crazy story. I mean, 5 pretty boys, right? Mm-hmm. Men, young men, were found brutally murdered in a sexually sadistic way. And they had the same kind of drugs in their system, right? Just crazy. The papers were going insane. And actually, the TV show 60 Minutes had an officer that was involved in the case on air and to talk about it. And he made this off the cuff kind of flippant comment about needing to break up this happy family of perpetrators, right? Well, so immediately the press latches on to the family part.
They love those monikers.
They love it. So they start calling it the family murders. But the press starts speculating that the murders of these guys, these five men, that they're all being carried out by a group of depraved sexual predators that are made up of high-profile businessmen, like judges and politicians and lawyers and all that kind of things in the area, right? So the paper started to call this group the family. And even though there's no hard evidence of these being high-profile people, the moniker stuck. And everybody, even today, it's called the family. The family. That's so now, Johnson. Yeah, exactly. So now the pressure's really on, not like it was before, but it's really on. And the police were following any lead that came in. And even though the staff was spread thin, anything that came in, they went to it. One call came in, stated that there were two men by the name of Mark and Doug that drove a light-colored 1963 E.J. Holden sedan in fairly good condition. The caller said that these two men were responsible for taking Richard. And police were so excited. They solid lead. They knew same kind of make and model. You know, that's what Alan was taken in, or the witness that Alan said. That's what the security guard claimed he heard was a Holden. So excited for it. Go to check it out. Nothing. Even information that was given out to the public, you know, offered a reward. Nothing. Lots of calls, but no leads. Police also get tips that these young men were being taken for snuff films or S&M films. Because, you know, once again, Richard had on that studded collar. And so they concentrated on that. They started looking at all these videos of snuff films and S&Ms. So nothing panned out with the snuff films or the S&Ms, except the detectives did get quite an education on both subjects.
I'd say so.
They decided to find out what the one thing all these men had in common was: the drugs that were in the bloodstream. And they were talking to this one chemist that was in the toxicology section of the Forensic Science Center. And that chemist recalls that in October of 82, this young kid reported to police that he had been picked up by a person in a car, taken to a house somewhere in Port Adelaide, and he thought he had been drugged, and he passed out.
What year was this?
1982. It was a year prior.
Huh.
It was a year prior to all this investigation. A year prior to Richard Kelvin going missing. Now, the detectives, of course, interviewed the boy and arranged to get his blood taken to have it analyzed. And although the test didn't prove anything, the chemist actually ran further and found that he had the Mandrax in the blood. Piqued the detective's interest. So they thought, you know what? Mandrax had just been regulated not too long ago, which meant that you had to get a prescription for it. And just like Adderall here in the city, the prescriptions are kept on file, and it's monitored, right? So they decided, basically, Mandrax was being abused, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Adderall was. The two detectives that worked the case, the one that that wrote the book, Bob O'Brien, and the other one was a more senior detective. His name was Trevor Kipling. They decided to go to the House Commission to look through the records to see if they can find anything that strikes their interest, right? They thought it was going to take forever, but it didn't take as long as they thought. As they were looking through the scripts, Trevor Kipling came across a name that piqued their interest. The name was Bevan Spencer von Einem. I know.
I'm sorry.
It's a mouthful, right?
It sounds fake.
It does. Now, Bevan von Einem is also famous for something else he actually helped. Back in 1972, the vice squad in Adelaide used to go down to the bridge over the Torrens River, and they did what they called poof flinging, or flinging a poof.
What?
Flinging a poof. And what they did is they would take gay men and fling them in the river instead of booking them on charges of homosexuality or lewd behavior. This was before it was legal.
Did it kill them? It didn't kill them, did it?
It killed one professor that they threw over the bridge. They threw, at one point, they threw three people over, one being a professor. He was killed. The other one was never named. And then the third one crawled to shore because he had a broken leg, and he was found by Von Einem. Von Einem, it's hard to say his name. Von Einem took him to the hospital. So that's how they knew him. Now, that's just the short story. There's more involved. The police were acquitted. I mean, it's horrible. That's why I said this has many different veins to the story. Mm-hmm. That's one way that the police knew Bevan's name. The other reason why it was familiar was because after Alan Barnes was found murdered, the police received an anonymous tip saying that Bevan Spencer Von Einem had been involved.
In the murder?
Of Alan Barnes, yes. Now, police had gone to interview Bevan, but they didn't do so until, like, months after Neil Muir's body was found. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when interviewed, Bevan claimed that he didn't know Alan Barnes, but he had known Neil, and that he had seen Neil the Saturday before he was killed. And in fact, Bevan even admitted to sleeping with Neil 4 years before. Now, this information was given to Detective Lee Holden, remember? He had had eyes on Dr. Milhouse, so he was so focused on Dr. Milhouse, he didn't even...
Tunnel vision for him.
Tunnel vision, exactly, right?
Yeah.
Police also find that other officers had spoke with him in March of 1982 when he was accused of picking up boys at the river and sexually assaulting them. And this was just a month after Mark Langley went missing. Nothing ever came about that either.
Why are they looking the other way?
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I think he came off as not being the guy. I don't know. I have no idea.
Doing some stuff that's not right.
No, but his name keeps popping up, and you would think that. And off, you know, it's
like
before
Edward
computers, right? And you know, it's one of those things that they didn't have computers back then, so different departments didn't. Right. You know, right now. The family members that they're called, they're doing investigated by the major crime squad unit, whereas other police officers or detectives are handling other cases. So I don't think the two get compared much. Totally speculating. Not for sure if that's true, but that's just what my uneducated opinion thinks. Bevan Spencer Von Einem was a 37-year-old, soft-spoken accountant. He wore glasses. He was around 6 feet tall. And he had started going gray when he was like 16 or 18, something like that. So he dyed his hair a dark color. People that he worked with knew he was gay, and the others that didn't know, what they weren't really surprised to learn that. So O'Brien and Kipling go to speak to Von Einem, and they tell him they have questions. They go to his house, and they tell him that they have questions about him using the drug Mandrax. I'm just going to call him Bevan. Because Von Einem is such a hard thing to say.
Like
I'm sorry.
Name.
I know. Bevan Spencer Von Einem. After about a slight pause, Bevan replies, you know, I'm not going to answer any questions without my solicitor. Solicitor, of course, being lawyer. And so the two detectives asks, you know, could you go call your lawyer and see we can get this going, right? So as Bevan is on his way to the phone, the detective notices that there's this very small elderly woman, and it's Bevan's mother. Looks like she lives with Bevan.
He's what? How old is he? 30?
He's 37 at the time.
Okay.
So now the solicitor, of course, tells Bevan not to speak with police, but he does agree to go down to the police station, and he gives a statement, and the solicitor's there. So Bevan was questioned for a few hours, and he told the detectives that he was gay, but denied knowing the young men who was killed. Like, they'd go, do you know Alan? No. Do you know? And he'd say, no. You know what I'm saying? Back and forth. When they asked him where he was when Richard Kelvin was abducted, Barron simply said that he was home in bed with the flu. And in fact, he had been off work for an entire week because of the flu.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Then they asked Bevan, you know, about what kind of drugs was he prescribed, right? Mm-hmm. And he had two drugs for a nervous condition, which makes me laugh because depression.
Yeah, they don't call it that anymore.
No. One is a doxepin, and the other one is a oxapam. I don't know. They're both, basically, they're both used for anxiety and depression, right?
Okay.
He also was prescribed Mandrax and Rohfenol to help him sleep. Although he didn't use the two together, of course, that would be highly dangerous. He had taken the Mandrax for about 5 years and then decided he wanted to get off them. You know, not he didn't want to get addicted. And then the doctor switched him to Rohfenol.
5 years later.
I know.
Okay.
The doctor switched him to Rohfenol. He said his last script for the Mandrax was about 12 months prior, but he still had some at home. And then the police asked, and this is a quote from the book, could you conceivably abduct a youth, drug him, abuse him, and then kill him? To which Bevan Spencer von Einem replied, no. I think it would be unethical of me. I shy away from violence of any description.
Okay, right there. Red flag, buddy. Red flag.
Thank you.
I'd be horrified with the question, I mean. Like, I wouldn't even put that much thought into it.
Right. Now, Bevan allowed the detectives, Bevan and his lawyer, I'm assuming, allowed the detectives to take nail scrapings, hair, and blood samples, and then allowed them to search his home and his car, which was a silver Toyota Corolla. But it is here, I will say, that von Einem did have a Ford Falcon, but he had sold it on July 16th, 1983, to raise money for his trip, which was pretty close to where a certain Richard Kelvin was abducted.
Yeah, I'm gonna
I'm
gonna put another red flag right here. Just saying.
Could totally be a coincidence. A team of police arrive at the von Einem's house at approximately about 4 o'clock, and they conduct an 8-hour search. And the house, they said, was very ordinary. The furniture was nothing fancy, but it wasn't quite low-end, just kind of modestly decorated. There was blue carpeting that had a light purple swirl, and it went through the entire house except the bedroom. The bedroom was like a dark blue carpeting, and they said the brightest color in the house was actually Bevan's bedspread, that he had a single bed, which I find odd for a grown man, but it was the 80s, who knows. The bedspread was yellow, but it had like yellow or orange checks throughout, like gingham, I guess, on a yellow background. And they also said, which I thought was weird, there was also the most expensive thing in the house was in his bedroom, and it was a harp. He had a harp. Well, kind of weird, right?
Well, he was an accountant, right?
Yeah.
So I would assume that he had some degree of education, and so he probably liked music too. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know. A harp is just not really anything. It has nothing to do with the case. I just thought that was weird that he had a harp. I don't know anybody that has a harp.
I think it's weirder about the single bed. I mean, that's just weird.
Yeah.
Is it not?
No.
Maybe it's not.
It's
weird.
Odd. I don't know. At the top of the bed, I guess by the headboard, the police found a duffel bag. Inside the bag was Bevan's credit card and a bottle of assorted pills that had the two antidepressants and anxiety meds. It also had the Rohfenol, and it had Valium. And inside the Valium was a slip of paper that had the words, Uncle Bevan, written on it.
What?
I know. They then asked, you know, where he kept the Mandrax pills, and Bevan gave them a bottle of 40 or so assorted capsules and tablets. And he had kept those at a different part of his bedroom. Now, I'm not really for sure exactly what it meant, but it was behind a mirror. So I don't know if the mirror was behind like a wardrobe, but he had made like these little shelves, and inside and on these shelves, that's where the bottle of Mandrax was found, and also another prescription bottle. And that was the prescription for Notec.
So not a medicine cabinet. With the
no, it wasn't a medicine cabinet. It was something that was in his bedroom behind a mirror. So I don't know if it was a wardrobe. Or if he had, like, it was kind of like a hiding spot. It wasn't anywhere that the doctor would actually look.
Yeah, shady.
The doctor, the police,
shady.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But besides the drugs, the police didn't find anything of interest. I mean, the techs did gather fiber from the carpets and beddings, and photographs were taken of the house. The fingerprint tech said that he hadn't found fingerprints in the bedroom at all, like even on the door handle. But he did state that when he spread the fingerprint dust around, like on the door, he could only see the whirls of the cleaning cloth. Nothing else. It had just been cleaned.
Did he know they were coming over?
He might have. I mean, he was taken down to the station.
Nobody has doorknobs with no fingerprints.
Right. The fingerprint guy actually was surprised, and he said it aloud that he couldn't believe how much cleaning had been done in the bedroom. The detectives O'Brien and Kipling decide to have a closer look at the story the chemist told him about that boy in 82 that was drugged. Remember? He went to a party?
Yeah.
So they find out the boy's name is George. He was 16 years old, and he had been hitchhiking on a Saturday night. And this happened on the 13th of September, 1982. It was approximately 6 months after Mark Langley went missing and 9 months before Richard Kelvin had been abducted. George was walking on the road when he said a man with glasses and a bronze Ford Falcon was filling up his cooler at an ice works and offered George a ride home. Ice works, when I looked it up, it said it was a skating rink.
Oh.
So I'm not really for sure. Okay. To me, it sounds more like a gas station.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
But I'm uncertain what an ice works actually is. But I included it just in case. So many of our Aussie friends or anybody that might know what an ice works is, let us know.
Oh, I guess it could be an ice skating rink. I was thinking roller skating, and I was thinking, why would they call it that? Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, this man offered George a ride. George, of course, takes the ride. And once he gets in the car, the man starts talking to George and says, hey, you want to go to a party? There's going to be girls and booze, and you're going to have a great time. It's going to be so much fun. George agrees, and he's taken to this house where these women lived.
Oh, okay.
So the man that had brought George to the house, which George can't remember the man's name, gave him alcohol, like beer and brandy, and offered him what he said was no-doze pills. You remember no-doze.
Oh, yeah.
They're like caffeinated or caffeine pills to keep you up. He said, you know, if you take those, it'll keep you awake and you're going to have fun, right? George takes pills, or says he takes the pills. He then proceeds to have sex with one of the women.
Nope.
But then passes out. Right. Then he arrives home in a taxi 27 hours later with a 1/2 centimeter tear in his anus. Now, George believed he had been drugged and abused, so he reported it to the police. Well, Detective Sam Bass, who later becomes a politician, so he's high-profile man, found out who the taxi driver, you know, the one that took George home, found out his name, and the taxi driver led him to the house where George was taken and found out that the man that had brought George to the house was none other than Bevan von Einem.
Get out!
Mm-hmm. So they go back and talk to Bevan.
So he's an accountant and a taxi driver?
No, the man. Did you not follow that?
No.
The taxi driver took the guys to the house, and the people at the house told the police that the man who brought George to the house was Bevan von Einem.
Yeah.
You got it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Bevan was an Uber driver before. Yeah. Before Ubers were a thing. Von Einem admitted to picking up the boy, but said that George had asked him for a ride. And Von Einem agreed, and he agreed that he'd offered to take the boy to a party where there were drugs, booze, and women. But Bevan said that George was willing to go, and he was willing to party. And Von Einem said that he drove to the house in Alberton, but the girls weren't there. They stayed there for a while. The man that lived there also said that the girls were working, but they came home about an hour later. And Von Einem said that he himself was the only one that took any drugs and that he had never offered George any pills. But George was just really, really drunk on beer and brandy. And he actually slept with one of the women. The women actually were transgendered women and then passed out. So
I was just thinking, of course, a 16-year-old boy is going to want to be up for a party.
Right.
I mean, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then with the lure of sex, come on.
Right. So Von Einem also claimed that George was out most of the following day, and that by the time he got up, he was still drunk. And they placed him in a taxi cab, gave the driver $15, and sent George home. Now, the woman that George slept with, they were going to put some pressure on the situation. They actually arrested her on rape charges, but the charges were later dropped. Nothing could really be proved. They now had proof that Bevan Van Eidam was picking up young men and drugging them, right? But could they prove that he was a murderer? The police department started investigating people in Van Eidam's circle of friends. One of these people was a businessman, and that's pretty much how he's described, as a businessman. He was from one of the more affluent areas and had known Van Eidam for years. And actually, this man's car had been seen by police in Van Eidam's driveway the night after police had searched his house. Weirdly enough, this gentleman's name had also been mentioned in anonymous calls to the police about the young men. The police searched his house and his car and his business, which was a two-story building. Now, the first floor was used only as the business. That's where all the business was run. The second floor was used as the administration office. But on the back of the second floor, there was a room with nothing in it but a mattress.
Ew.
Police took the mattress and searched it. Nothing came up, at least nothing that was helpful to this investigation. But the police did put a track on him. They started following him around for a while, and they found that every day at lunch, he went to all the popular gay pickup spots looking for men.
At lunchtime?
At lunchtime, for the entire hour. In fact, they said he was like quite a creeper. And one of those places that he would go to was underneath the King William Road Bridge along the River Torrance, the number one gay pickup spot. They also spoke to the three people that lived in the house where George had his party, one male and two transgender women. The house was searched, but nothing of evidence was found. But police got to thinking, you know, this transgender woman, maybe they're one of the ones that were in the car. That you remember the witness said that when Richard was abducted, they thought they heard a female voice?
Yeah. Well, of course it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
No proof. They don't have any proof. But they thought that's what possibly happened.
One of those ladies are the ones that had sex with George, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Her name, later found out this woman's name was Prue, and she's since passed.
Prue?
But yeah. Prue. P-R-U. Prue. Mm-hmm. That was the one that was arrested. So
how
police...
Because George is 16, right?
George was 16. She was an adult. She was of age.
Yeah.
That's why they tried to get her for rape, but nothing stuck. So police returned to the original caller that brought them to Baron Van Eidam in the first place, and they tracked him down. Took him a long time. He was kind of a transient. Moved from place to place, right? So when they finally track him down... was in the beginning of November of 1983. He came into the police department and he was interviewed. And what he said shocked. It was almost unbelievable. They couldn't believe.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He's known as B, and he is a witness, or he was a witness to Bevan's trial, which we'll later find out. But he's only known as B.
Okay.
For his security.
Yes, there you go.
So B had met Van Eidam at the boathouse by the Torrance River. Remember the number one pickup spot for gay men? I don't believe that's in the travel brochures, but that was what it was. And B said that one night, the two picked up two male hitchhikers in Van Eidam's Falcon. Van Eidam offered them a drink that he kept in a cooler. B said he always had a cooler in the trunk of the car and in the back seat, which he kept under a pile of clothes in case he got pulled over by the cops.
That's not creepy at all.
Mm-hmm. So the boys were offered a beer from the cooler, and B said that Van Eidam also gave them Rohinol. And I'm unsure if they actually gave him to him as like a no-dose tablet or if they put it in the drink. Unclear on that. So they then took the boys to Van Eidam's place, which B said they could because Van Einem's mother was gone, which she was every 2 weeks because she went to visit her cousin. So they brought the boys in the home and Von Einem asked B to help with undressing them. Now they keep one of the boys in the living room, and one of the other one is taken into Von Einem's bedroom. B also said that Von Einem showed him the little pill collection that was behind the mirror. So the detectives then kind of knew that B's not really a bullshitter. He knows what he's talking about,
he's
right?
Lying. Right.
Von Einem asked B to help them undress both boys. And then Von Einem goes and shuts the door into his bedroom. Goes to the bedroom, shuts the door, and he's in there with the other boy. Now, B is in the living room with the other boy. And when asked if he had done anything to the boy, B said that he didn't touch the boy in the living room because the boy seemed very sick, like he was going to get sick from the drugs or the drink. Yeah. And also, this is so cold, the boy wasn't good looking. He didn't find the boy attractive. So B later states that a while later, he went into Von Einem's bedroom, just walked in, didn't knock. And he caught Von Einem in the act of sticking a flashlight into the boy's rectum.
Well, I think it's clear who's doing this then. How come he's not dead or gone? Is he? I don't know. Go ahead.
What, the boy?
No, Van Idiot.
Van Einem? Just hold on.
Just getting fired up.
I know.
Just getting fired up.
B told Von Einem at that point that he just wanted to go home, so he made up any excuse that he could. And he's like, you know what? The guy in the living room, he's waking up. I just want to go home. And Von Einem replied, you know what? If he wakes up, I'm going to kill him. Which, those words weren't exactly used. There was more horrible words were used. Von Einem then told B to help him get the boys dressed so he could drop them off at a friend's house so they could sleep the drugs off and then be sent home.
He's got so many under his control. Mm-hmm. Like, what is he doing? What is he giving them? What does he have on them?
Or what? I don't know.
You know what I mean?
Giving them drugs? Maybe they're giving these people drugs. And then when asked where they took the boys, it was the same house that the transgenders lived. And it seemed that they did this many, many times. And B went on to list, you know, all the different times. What finally stopped them was B said that one was so young, he didn't even have pubic hair. And at that point,
was it the 14-year-old?
Don't know.
Didn't say.
But he was young, probably around that age, 13 or 14, that he was so young that he didn't have any pubic hair. And that is what upset B more than any of the others. So he told V just, you know, once he got undressed, B just said, you know what, take me back to town. So, and then when asked why B hung out with Von Einem, and pretty much it was because that Von Einem would give him money and drugs and alcohol.
So, I mean, he had to be, there has to be, they all are doing something for each other. Because, like you said, who keeps your mouth shut with all that?
Right. Only two can keep a secret if one of them is dead, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Not long after the interview with B, the fiber analysis come back. And out of all the samples that were taken from Richard's clothes, 200 came from Von Einem's place.
Wow.
The blue and purple from the carpet. They even found fibers from a cardigan that Von Einem owned. And the hair that they found in Richard's pants lacked pigment and had been dyed.
Oh.
And the dye matched the solution that Von Einem's hairdresser used. Immediately, police go to Bevan Von Einem's home and place him under arrest for the murder of Richard Kelvin. When he's faced with the trace evidenced against him, Bevan Von Einem says, oh, you know what? I recall picking up Richard Kelvin and taking him back to my place. And he agreed with it, of course. But he left. I don't remember where he went afterwards. Which, judging by the fibers, they could tell it wasn't true because he had on the same clothes. He was gone for 7 weeks. Now, if I had what I'm wearing and I went to your house, I would pick up fibers. But within 3 days of me wearing the same clothes, most of the fibers from your house would not be on me any longer.
Mm-hmm.
They would fall off. Mm-hmm. In fact, there wasn't even many fibers from Richard's clothes that were from Richard's house because he had been gone so long. So I'm going to save you all the details of the trial, because I've already given all of the everything to you, the evidence. Mm-hmm. But on November 5th of 1984, Bevan Spencer von Einem was found guilty of Richard Kelvin's murder sentenced to life with a non-parole period of 24 years. And then later, the non-parole period would be upped to 36 years. And he's currently in Yaddala, I believe that's how it's pronounced, Yaddala Labor Prison.
So that SOB is still alive.
Mm-hmm. He's still alive. He's in his 70s now. He was born in 1945. So he's 75 years old now.
Did he ever confess to any of this?
Never confessed. He's always remained innocent. In fact, the only thing that he's ever admitting to doing is that I believe in 2016, he was caught with child pornography in prison. And he was given 3 extra months. People are still on the lookout for this so-called family of these members, which mm-hmm. the police believe that there are up to 12 men. And many of them live high-profile lives in Australia. And mm-hmm. what they do is they search out young men and drug and rape them. Some even claim that it goes people in the church are involved, which, you know, sounds weird, but it happens. We all know.
It does not sound weird at all.
You know?
It's perfectly plausible after what we know now.
And as of March 2008, there is a $1 million reward that's been offered to anyone who gives any information leading to a conviction. Now, and this is interesting, I think, and it's all hearsay, but in early of 2014, and I got this from the article of the Advertiser, an article from the newspaper called the Advertiser, I should say, that in early 2014, family members of a man by the name of Trevor Peters, who had died, recently deceased, were going through his personal items, and they found a diary he had written, and in it linked Bevan von Einem to the murder of Alan. Well, not the murder, but linked him to Alan Barnes. In fact, diary entries said Peters actually saw photos of Barnes in the possession of von Einem. And when Peters asked von Einem who it was, von Einem replied, "Oh, that's just some hitchhiker."
Hmm.
So, well, and it also states, it also states in the article that Trevor Peters was a known associate of people that are and were suspected to be key players in the family. But nothing, I tried to search, there's nothing more on it. I know the police are taking it seriously. And actually, he saw this at, believe it or not, this is all hearsay, I should say. Trevor Peters saw the photos while von Einem was getting his hair done, and he was sharing them with his hairdresser, whose nickname was Pussy, believe it or not. Real name was Dennis St. Dennis, I believe.
Dennis
St. Dennis, I believe. I didn't write it down, but I believe that's what it was. And later, when Trevor asked Dennis St. Dennis when he was on his deathbed, that he died, I think he died at 90, he said, "Oh, you don't know anything. And if you know what's best for you," and I'm paraphrasing this, "if you know mm-hmm. if you know what's best for it, you don't know anything either." But it's also rumored that von Einem and this hairdresser rented a unit somewhere, like a house somewhere together. So it's possible that that's where it is. It's also possible that Bevan von Einem did all this by himself.
I don't think so.
No. Later, at the final chapters of the book, Bob O'Brien, the detective, you know, was talking with the other detective, Trevor Kipling, and he's like, you know, they both agreed they wished they would have gone more into the transgender women and the other man. No, they wish they could have found something to arrest them on and after them further to find out more information, but there just wasn't enough to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I have. It goes so deep, and I'm telling you, there's so many rabbit holes. There's another pedophile ring with a mother goose. So much. This could go on forever, but I didn't want to bore everybody. I'll put some links on, you know, the show notes and on our website mm-hmm. if anybody's interested.
Mm-hmm. I think I agree with you when I say he did not do that alone. There's no way.
Mm-mm.
Then also, him living with his mother, where did he hide these people for 5 weeks or days even?
Well, that's where they think that maybe there was a, had somewhere.
Another place?
He had to have.
And then,
I mean,
here's my other,
his mother would go away, but where would all the blood go? Where would all the blood go? They'd have to find something, but I guess they didn't have luminol or anything back then in the 80s, did they? I don't know. I'm not up on my forensic.
I think luminol came about in the late 80s, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But we'll be told on that, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Remind us. However, so here's my other question. Mm-hmm. I wonder if he did this a lot. Like, there are way other victims, because honestly, you know that there's, just like with rape victims, sometimes they're embarrassed to come forward mm-hmm. and admit, you know, that why was I at that? They blame themselves, basically. Right.
Mm-hmm.
When they are totally not in fault at all, ever, no matter what. But how many other victims there were, and if these particular guys, he didn't mean to kill them, but like the torture, you can only take so much. And that's why he chopped them up so badly.
Right.
Because he didn't really mean to kill them. Do you know what I'm saying? And
right.
it like freaked him out versus doing this. Like you said it early, Bill Cosby, mm-hmm. if you wake up and you don't remember what's wrong, but your bottom's sore, well, you know, something's not right. Right.
right.
Or you
mm-hmm.
have some bruises and stuff. But you're like, well, it was a wild party, especially with the kid that had sex with the lady at that house, right? So it's mm-hmm. like, wow, that did I just forget? Was I really out of it? You know.
And
what
if
I mean?
It's a young boy, that's the last thing they're going to want to admit.
Yeah,
they
no
don't
way.
Even know their own sexuality, really, or at least come to terms if they are gay.
Right. So I said, at 16, he might not have ever had sex yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right. No,
oh, wow.
Just, it's amazing. But at one point, I believe I read that there is up to 200 victims of the family that are perpetrated by these, what they believe, this group of men. But
yeah, that's what
it's also, is there really a group of men? Are they copycats? Are there just a bunch of people going around doing the same thing? You know, just like, hey, mm-hmm. well, I like young boys. Let's drug them. Yeah, as far as I know of anything going on to this day, didn't come across it, except other pedophilia rings. And once I read the one about Mother Goose, I knew I couldn't dive deep into it because I had to get this finished.
Right, right.
But so I don't really know quite what was involved in that whole sting operation. But quite a lot of high-profile people were caught diddling little kids.
I think that happens way more than we know.
Unfortunately, yeah.
You know, and I think that's a whole other podcast, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just say, when you first started talking about this, I was like, wow, I looked this up while you were doing this, of course. This seems a little familiar, because a long time ago, I watched a series, and it was an Australian series, and it is called Deep Waters, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it is not, I thought when you started to dive into this, I was like, ooh, I wonder if that's it, because I couldn't remember the name. The little girl that's in Orange is the New Black is actually from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is the lead detective in this series. But it is based on the real life case that happened in Bondi. Sorry. And I've been there and I still can't say it right. But it is based on a real life murder of gay men. Not this, but you know what I mean? You just have to wonder. There was some similarity. So anyway, the show is called Deep Waters, if you guys want to check it out. I don't know where you can find it. I watched it a long time ago. It was actually really, really good. And I was shocked that cute little girl from Orange is the New Black had in such a good Australian accent. Well, then, yeah, it's because she is Australian. But on Orange is the New Black, she has an awesome New York accent.
New York. Yeah, well, I originally came across this from a TV show called Crime Investigation Australia. I was able to find it through the Roku, like downloading random apps. And that's mm-hmm. where I first came across it. And then, of course, I looked into it and saw that there was a book, and I'm much better at with the book than mm-hmm. anything else. And of course, this one, like I said, this, since the man who wrote it, or maybe he had a ghostwriter, I don't know, was one of the lead investigators, it has all the deep information in that you wouldn't find in. And for some reason, I couldn't bring up the court documents. I don't know if they're kept locked up, or normally I can find court documents, but I couldn't. I could just find newspaper articles. And when you find the newspaper, sometimes it gets really confusing with dates. So that's why I used some newspaper articles,
mm-hmm.
but it's peppered in with mostly from,
you know, this
the
is
book
where
Youngblood.
This is where my conspiracy theorist personnel mind goes. Mm-hmm. course you're not going to find those documents. And of course, somebody had to take the fall. So Von Idiot took the fall because all these other people couldn't take the fall. You see what I'm saying? So if there are judges and attorneys and police, whatever.
Well, you know, the businessman that they saw that was perving on people or creeping on people, and he had the mattress back in the room of his building. He actually was one of the first people to visit Bevan in prison. But then over the years, he's not seeing them much. He hasn't gone to see him in years. No letters, nothing. So it kind of makes you wonder if there was something going on, especially since he was the first person. He was at Bevan's house the night the police searched his house, too. I mean, it was a weird coincidence. They could have been best friends, too, because I'd call you if police came to search my house. I don't know if you'd come over that night.
Depending on what the issue was, right? If you had a boy in your house for 5 weeks, I'm going to say I'll see you. I'll swing by the cell tomorrow. But, you know, this goes back to that I just recently, these times, it's all I do is I watch something and then I get stuck on the rabbit hole, whatever. But it did make sense. Like these pedophiles, you befriend each other and it's dark, it's deep, right? But that is the connection that you have. So for instance, it's those secrets. Do you see what I'm saying? So like they share god awful, sickening photos of these poor babies with each other. Well, that makes them both guilty. So then they have that secret that bonds them. You know what I mean? So like that guy that came to see him in jail, that's the first thing I thought of was like, okay, you're not giving me up, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's sick. It's, to me, it's one of the lowest forms.
No, to me, it is the lowest form, period. I can't even. I can't.
I'd harm them. You know, I tried to look into Von Einem's past. There wasn't really a lot. I couldn't really find much. I know his dad, of course, was your typical strict man, but really not a lot was found on it. Oh, and I did forget to mention, too, here's another thing. The witness B claimed that Von Einem told him that Von Einem had something to do with the missing Beaumont children.
Get out.
And it kind of adds up. And this is another rabbit hole that I couldn't even get into it, because Von Einem would have been about 20 years old at the time. And with his white hair, you know, there was a mention of a blonde man. I'm bad at sketches, you know, sketch artists' renditions. The sketch artist could possibly show that it was Von Einem.
With his gray hair, it could be either gray or blonde, but it could also be a young man or an older man, right?
Right.
It could go either way, depending on who saw it.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Put that link on there, because
I will put that link too. There's a newspaper article that I'll see if I can get the link to you.
I would not be surprised. When does one cross the line? When do they start and how far it goes? You know
what's
what I'm
your
saying?
Obsession? Mm-hmm. But he denies it. He's like, I've never said that. Lying and.
Yeah, but you know what?
But yeah, it's mentioned.
Once you're that kind of person, don't tell me about that. I didn't say that. I don't believe a single word you say. You're done. Like you're
right.
You're no.
So much has happened since he's been in prison. You know, they tried to get him for the murder of Alan and Mark, but then started to go to trial. It did go to trial, and then charges were dropped. I mean, just it goes on and on and on, and it's never ending, and it had to end somewhere.
He probably harbors so many secrets we'll never know. He might have been a patsy, too, getting these young, cute boys, having these people work for him, get these young, cute boys in there, and other people were in on it. You know what I mean? Just like other people showing up, doing this, and then accidentally killing them. Like in, you know, the olden days of Hollywood, where it was you had your fix-it person. Oh, God, come fix this. You know what I mean? So who knows? I don't know.
I know. But the only other podcast that I know that has done this, besides the one that I think is just all hearsay, is our friends at Unresolved, Mike Will. He always does such a bang-up job. I haven't listened to it yet, but I know it's top quality, and I'm sure maybe he's missed some, or he put something in that I missed, or left out. So I also suggest, if you're interested, to try that situation too.
I like doing that too sometimes, because sometimes what I think is important, other people don't include. But like you, I tried never to listen to it before.
No. Because why would we do that to our friends?
Not to mention, it'd be like, oh my God, they did such a great job. I'll never. And then I would quit everything. I'd be like, never mind. I'm not doing that one. They did it so well. I'm not doing it. Yeah.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
you did a bang up job. Good
well,
job,
thanks. Tim. Well, this is going to be our last episode until
ever.
No. Are you kidding? We'll probably never give this up. I guess the week will be on break from May 24th, which in the US is Memorial Weekend week. And then the following week, and then we'll be back the week of June 7th.
Yep. We got some good little plans for you coming up to our return and shortly thereafter.
Yep. And we'll still be on Get Vocal, too. I'm not sure if we're going to be taking a break from there. I know we took one last week. I don't know what we'll be doing with that. But
mental health is important for me. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Same here. Same here, bud. That's why we need a little break.
A little break.
But also, stay tuned. Before our bloopers, if there are any bloopers, I'm not for sure. We have a promo from our friends at Three Spooked Girls.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah.
Good job, Jen.
Yeah, thanks.
But, remember, you guys, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love you.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all Our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at WeTalkOfDreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya.
Hey there, I'm Tara.
And I'm Jessica, and together we co-host the podcast Three Spooked Girls.
If you love the paranormal
or murder,
join us on Mondays for full-length episodes where we discuss our favorite paranormal stories and true crime cases.
And join us again on Thursdays for our mini-sodes called Stabby Snippets, where we tell you all about true crimes happening in the news.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, wherever the hell else you listen to your pods at. You can also find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook by using the handle at Three Spooked Girls.
Come and hang out with us and get your spooky on while we scare the hell out of you.
Okay. Is it in Australian language?
It is in Australian.
I had to. I'm sorry.
South Australia, basically. Oh, okay. South Australia. Okay. Yeah. State of Adelaide. Or I don't know how that works. Cut all that out.
All right, let's go, Jan.
And one thing that I read suggested golden showers, but that's all hearsay. That's not fact.
So wait, would he? Never mind. I'm not even going to go there.
I'm assuming it was a drug test. I'm assuming the doctor did a drug test, right? That's all it was. So grain of salt there. I just thought it was kind of funny. I mean, I wouldn't know. I couldn't tell you, you know, but I guess if you're really into cars, you might be able to know this.
But you could also like have a muffler, you know, some people like the loud muffler or whatever.
So well, they do it supposedly it's by the cylinder, if it's a V8 or a 4-cylinder, or I don't know. I didn't understand it when I was reading
it. Make sure to stay tuned to Jen and Cam's car podcast coming up next.
I mean, I don't even know the difference between make and model. You know, I'm just, I get confused. I can tell you it was a green car. That's all I can tell you. Like gingham, I guess, on a yellow background. I had that growing up. I had an orange and yellow bedroom growing up, so that's not unusual. Now it's kind of gross.
He's 37. He can't clean his own doorknob.
Exactly. Which, that's a nice little, yeah, so anyway.
Euphemism.
I know.
I'm going to start using that. Okay, go ahead. Sorry. Okay.
Detectives O'Brien and Kipling decide to have a closer look.
That's funny.
It is funny. Oh, it's very funny.
I'm sitting here like so paying attention and concentrating on what you're saying. So that like threw me off the edge. Okay, go ahead.
So,